Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, I am joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
Just surviving, Nicholas. Just surviving.
That's good. Always better than the alternative. We're also joined for the first time on the show today by Anlu Kiva. Anlu, very good to have you with us.
Thanks, Nicholas. It's nice to be here.
Indeed, indeed. So let us get into the news of today. It's a lovely autumn day in Johannesburg, the best time of year, in my opinion. And our first story is about the ongoing tensions between the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Department and the South African Police Service, the SAPS. We are seeing at the moment simmering tensions of cop versus cop. This is all in the wake of the shooting dead of a JMPD police officer. As far as I remember, I think this happened about a month ago. The story's details are something along the lines of the JMPD officer had a son who was allegedly driving recklessly. He drove towards his mother's house, jumped out of the car, ran into the house to take shelter while being pursued by the cops. The cops then got into an argument with the JMPD officer who was off duty at the time. Apparently, there were threats, and it ended in a gun battle between the two where the JMPD officer was shot dead. JMPD officers protested earlier this month outside their headquarters following this killing. They seem to believe that the cops should account for the shooting dead of one of the JMPD. So earlier this week, there was a meeting between SAPS and JMPD officers and senior management to try and defuse these tensions between the two organizations. Terence, some interesting aspects to this one. I don't think it's particularly unusual for different branches of the police to come into conflict with each other. I mean, if you watch too many crime TV shows, you'll see, of course, that old tired trope of the FBI and the state police in American TV fighting over who gets jurisdiction and whose case this is. But I think the key is, can you manage those tensions, which are inevitable? And it really seems, I think, here, like they are not being managed. And as you remember perhaps better than I, this is not the first time that the SAPS and JMPD have come to blows with each other.
Nicholas once again calls attention to my age. Now, I hope that also implies attention to my experience. Yes, 2008, there was a JMPD strike, and during rush hour, protesting Metro police officers blockaded the M2. Police were sent in there to free up the flow of traffic, and shots were exchanged. While motorists, hit the deck, as one does in rush hour traffic in South Africa, in fear of their lives. Now, I actually had a question asked in the legislature a couple of years later as to what action had been taken, because discharging a firearm is a very serious offense. Discharging it, while a crowd of bystanders are there, that's the stuff of the numbers gang, or numbers gangs. Just here, it's two agencies of state. Nothing was done. It was just, one of those things, Friday afternoon in Johannesburg or whatever it was. But yes, I think one of the issues is that South Africa is quite unique internationally in that we have one police force. This has its roots in the ANC's dislike of devolution. Well, to be fair, they inherited that from the Nats. But despite all the evidence that policing works best when it's decentralized, the ANC was adamant that it was not going to concede any kind of coercive power to anyone but itself, and hence we have a very centralized and essentially unaccountable police system, unaccountable to local communities where officers can sort of be shifted around the country. What your Metro Police constitutes is essentially an auxiliary force with very, very limited powers, certainly no investigative powers. And I think a lot of competition over, and I would say bitterness over how over how these roles are structured. The SAPS, I think, would tend to look down on their metro colleagues as, you know, just sort of traffic wardens, whereas the whereas they would you know, want to demonstrate their role in the maintenance of law and order on the tough streets of Johannesburg. And unfortunately, you know, I think that there's also issues here with police training. It does seem to be, and I think also just with the trauma of dealing with the kind of violence that we have. I mean, it seems to me that there is a massive problem in a society where members of two law enforcement agencies actually fire at each other. You know, as much as you talk about the disputes between different policing agencies in America, I can't think of any, you know, that have actually resulted in that sort of thing. You know, here there's something that. There's something that's gone very wrong.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different issues to kind of pull from this one. One is there's a sort of, you know, one of the supposed benefits of having a very centralized system is that you should always know who's kind of in charge and who takes preference and that kind of thing. And it seems as though JMPD seemed to not agree with that. That the national police are superior. So it's like we're not even getting the benefit of a centralized system. But it's also, you know, you can also fit this into the larger issue of police brutality in South Africa. We have had so many cases in South Africa, and the worst ones were during the COVID lockdowns. We had cops harassing people. We had people beaten by soldiers and cops. We had people killed by soldiers and cops. Like Collins Causa. And so there is also a question as to whether this particular incident could have been de-escalated or whether it was unavoidable that it would turn into violence. Sometimes that does happen. Sometimes it's not the cop's fault. But as you say, Terrence, you know, with what we know of the relatively poor levels of training and the relatively high number of violent incidents committed by the cops, one does have to wonder whether the bloodshed here could have been avoided in the first place. Anlu, your thoughts on this issue in general, what do you think of these sanctions?
Nicholas, well, for starters, it's kind of ironic that SAPS was after her son for reckless driving. That's kind of ironic in the first place, given that it's the Metro Police. But that aside, I just started watching the second season of Chasing the Sun. And if you'd allowed me to make that extension, I know episode 3, which I just watched a little bit late, but episode 3 has this where Ibn Etzebet and Siya Kolisi and Bongi is taken aside. And they were told to listen, if amongst the three of you, there's not one voice, then the whole team can be expected to be disorganized and unsure of what to do. And if I can to extend it there, then say that they should definitely take a leaflet of paper here from their book. I think it's much better for them to, given these disparities that they have and that they don't want to agree with each other, whether it's in terms of who's the higher authority or whatever the difference may be, this is something that should be sorted out behind closed doors. And it should have not gone to the point where a weapon is involved at all. I understand that this scenario specifically is for her son, of course, but it definitely does have the overarching disparities between the entities.
Let me just make a comment here, which maybe throw a bit of a spanner in the works of all of our contributions, including my own. The Metro Police officer, I understand, was off duty. Was this clear? What apparel was being worn, and did the person in question identify a woman? Right, identify herself as such. You know, look, that may, you know, if the police entered a house and saw an armed, an armed civilian pointing a firearm at them, their action there might, might take on a very different, a very different vantage point. However, that does raise questions of, you know, what are the responsibilities of law enforcement agencies in this sort of situation? Presumably the police officers were in uniform, and if they were entering the premises, then surely another law enforcement officer should understand that they maybe have some just cause to be there. So I do think that before passing definitive judgment on this, it's important to get those facts. But so, certainly, it does say something about the national condition that we're having this discussion at all.
No, I definitely agree with that. The IPED report into this, the IPED spokesperson commenting on this matter, said that kind of makes it clear that the JMPD officer seems to have been in the wrong here. She wasn't on duty. Her son had effectively been arrested. And she tried to prevent this, argued with the cops, went back into her house to fetch her service weapon, and then came out and ended up in the gunfight with them. I think that also says something about why the JMPD, you know, this is, if those are indeed the facts, this is clearly a case where the JMPD should have not have cause to protest, because it was a justified shooting in that case. In which case they shouldn't be taking this as a sort of turf gang war thing where, they shot dead one of ours, so now we need vengeance. And I think that speaks to a larger issue of discipline in these
cases. Absolutely.
Okay, let us move on to our next topic. And this is about the contempt of court order that has been found against the ANC with regards to the CADA deployment records. So if you've been following the news and listening to the show, you will know that a while ago, the ANC was forced to hand over the records of its CADA deployment committee to the DA, who said that these documents were a matter of public importance. The court found that the ANC did indeed have to hand them over, that these things could not be just sort of squirted away and said, oh no, it's all part of internal organizational stuff, considering that this may constitute violations of the separation between party and state. The ANC hummed and hawed, and they said, well, we can give you some of these things, we can't give you all of them, because when Cyril Ramaphosa was in charge of the CADA deployment committee of the ANC, we just didn't keep any notes, just no notes. And then they also had some other sort of stories about how they had deleted some of these by accident and they weren't backed up, which, as far as I'm concerned, are plausible, but of course it's suspicious circumstances. Anyway, so the ANC ended up handing over what they said they had to the DA, and the DA said that too much was redacted and too much was missing, and they said that the ANC is deliberately holding them back. So they went to court. The court found that the ANC had been in contempt of court for not handing over the full documents they were requested to hand over. However, the ANC has now appealed that decision, saying that there's no proof that they had shown any bad faith or intent to deceive. These attributes are not present in the ANC's handling of the matter, said a spokesperson. The ANC instead processed information which it had and explained its reasons for redacting some of the documents, and explained that non-existing records of 2013 to 2018, the latter could not be disputed by the DA, and they ended up conceding to the same. This cannot be bad faith. Terence, what do you make of this story? I wonder, you know, some of this is are really based on questions of fact, to which we will, I don't think, ever have an answer, really. It's very possible that there weren't records kept of those meetings. There's also possible that those records were deleted. I think both are equally plausible. What do you make of this story?
Well, I think I've said it before, I think this is probably one of the most important stories since 1994. Also said, I'm very doubtful that we'll ever get a proper answer. As far as records being kept goes, we know from what they have released that they approved the minutes of the previous meeting. So yes, there definitely were records kept. And from what I've heard from ANC insiders, there is nothing that goes unrecorded. So yeah, I mean that the stuff that they've released. Funnily enough, the redactions I don't think are that important because essentially all of that was released to the Zondo Commission without redactions, and that can be found by a simple Google search. So you know the ANC really hasn't given the DA a damn thing. Now the order related not just to minutes but also to emails, to email threads, to WhatsApp messages, etc. It's highly unlikely, to my mind, that all of that stuff sort of, you know, uniformly vanished. The DA also claims that the ANC never, during their court case, raised the defense that these records don't exist. Although Ramaphosa did say that at the Zondo Commission. For what it's worth, I don't believe him, and I think there's issues about who's telling porkies under oath. But I think here's the problem. How do you know where to look to verify that something does or does not exist? I wonder if there's not some sort of cloud server that things are backed up onto. Certainly if they're asking for emails and for WhatsApps, that should be reasonably easy wouldn't go into the dog ate my homework legal defense. But I think that essentially what the ANC is doing is they're playing for time. They're not quite sure how to make this go away, but they want it kicked off until after the election. I think the irony there is that it's been apparent for so long that they've been helping shysters into important positions, but no one's going to be surprised. I think the person who really would suffer is that it would destroy Cyril Ramaphosa's pretensions that he was a lone voice against state capture, and he was biding his time until he could strike back definitively. And I think this will expose him for what I believe he was, which was an accomplice in the process.
I think that point in particular is the central reason why the records, when Cyril Ramaphosa was in charge of this CADA deployment committee meeting, if they have indeed been spirited away or burned or whatever, that will be the reason, because the entirety of the ANC's sort of campaign on its justification for itself, on its reason for why in this election you should give them another chance as to why Cyril Ramaphosa, this is why one of the reasons why Cyril Ramaphosa was so popular until relatively recently, was because there was this perception that he had been the one thing maybe holding back the tide of the state capture project by the Jacob Zuma faction of the ANC. But it's very likely that these CADA deployment records would show what you could see if you saw Ramaphosa in Parliament at the time during the Zuma years when he was the deputy president, that indeed there was very little distinction, that he was in fact very closely aligned with the Zuma camp, and while he did eventually fall out with Zuma, it was not over issues so high-minded as the ANC's control of state institutions. But Unlu, I think one of the sort of, apart from Cyril Ramaphosa's involvement in state capture, the other really big thing about, I think, these documents is they demonstrate how widespread and how toxic the CADA deployment policy of the ANC has been for the South African state and society. What do you make of the story?
Well, Nicholas, I completely agree with what Terence have said. In the first place, I think they're playing for time. I think it's nothing other than appealing, and it'll be another appeal. I don't know how many times they can, but they're playing for time until the election's over. And it's to some extent exactly that solidifies the idea that they are acting in bad faith. They're not acting they're acting in their own interest, which is, for us, bad faith. But yeah, it's very evident the degree to which these documents would actually affect their campaign. And I think exactly that is why they're playing for time. It's I completely agree with that. It's playing for time.
Terence, do you have any final thoughts on this one before we move on?
Look, as I say, I think this is a monumentally important issue. And I believe I was speaking at a conference a week or so ago, and talking about the state of our state-owned enterprises. And I showed a quote from an ANC document in 1997 that a transformation of the state entails, in the first instance, the extension of the power of the national liberation movement over all levers of power, which prosecuting authority, police, army, and parastatals. And I said, in that lay South Africa's decline. In that statement, and I think it's important to understand this. This was not a Zuma thing. Zuma crested a wave that had been coming since then. I remember the introduction of quota deployment. I remember Nelson Mandela standing up and saying that the time for self deployment is over. And as much as South Africa loved President Mandela. And as much as I think that there is much to admire about him, in this particular instance, it was under his leadership that South Africa's constitutional order was dealt a fatal corrupting blow, from which which has been central to everything else that has followed. My sense, though, is that if they can simply appeal until the appeals run out and then just claim, "Well, there's nothing to see here," what do you really do? Do you throw someone in prison for burning the documents? Or here's an interesting thought, and if there's a lawyer, you can confirm this. I was once told, and this is going back into the early 90s, that there is an obscure a practice where a complainant in a particular matter can apply for the right to search the premises of someone that he's got instituting legal action against. This is the idea that you get to go through your brother-in-law's house, like looking for your wife's knickers or something like that. And I wonder if something like this might not end up happening. Everyone in the studio house, stand away from your computers for the next 3 days while our IT guy goes through it.
Yeah, I suspect anyone who attempted to do that would have their way blocked by rather large, ununiformed bodyguards who would make sure that such a thing never happened.
In other words, it'd be like the M2 in 2008.
Indeed it would. Hey, look, there's a nice little neat thread running between these two stories. Anyway, let's go on to our third story, and this is also about the ANC and its election. So we are, of course, getting into the final weeks of the election, and the ANC is, as it usually does, pulling out all of the stops for the end of the campaign season. Now, while the ANC has been polling very poorly, they have traditionally managed to recover their vote share, at least somewhat, in the final weeks of the campaign, when they kind of throw the whole kitchen sink at everything. Their campaign is usually pretty late running and very large at the end. So it remains to be seen whether the ANC will be able to actually recover their vote share from what the polls have predicted. And as part of that, they have sent out former President Thabo Mbeki on the campaign trail in Soweto. Now, this is quite interesting because, firstly, Thabo Mbeki has been very critical of the ANC in recent years, starting kind of with his dethroning in 2008 and the beginning of the Zuma years. But his criticisms of the ANC continued into the Ramaphosa years. And the reason why some of this is important, I think, is because Thabo Mbeki is, I believe, by some reckonings, now the most popular politician in the country. Part of that, I think, is because there's a sort of nostalgia. When President Mbeki was president, we had economic growth reaching kind of 5-7%. Not 7%, I wish. But we had decent economic growth. We had the state functioning better. He managed to achieve a number of wins on the international stage for South Africa. And so he's been deployed now to go and campaign for the ANC. He's agreed to do so. And he was talking to people in Soweto. He was met by a crowd of ANC supporters. People just wanted to shake his hand, some people chanting his name. He said, those who are corrupt, who are part of the party, we need to get rid of them. I will urge you, Sowetans, when you go to the polls, do what you are supposed to do. I am grateful for the reception I've received. I was happy to see the faces of the people. They are confident the problems you are facing are going to be solved. So when I tell you to vote ANC, it's because we have solutions. Now, what's kind of interesting is this piece, I can't remember what it's from, I think it's from the Daily Maverick, contained a couple of interviews with people who were ANC supporters who had met Mbeki on the day. One guy said essentially that, quote, the service delivery is not that good. We hope that the ANC will give us better service delivery this time around. I am inspired by Thabo Mbeki. He is my role model. Another guy said, in my ward, we have issues with electricity. Our power is switched off without consultation. The ANC is an organization we have been there for. It's not. It's just that the people in power are the ones who are destroying the party with their corruption and money laundering. But what can we do? It's our party. And the last one said, the former president being here, it shows the veterans still believe in the ANC. I think it's 50-50 because in some areas the ANC is succeeding. The 350 Rand grant helps us. There are challenges like the rising price of food. So I think here you see kind of the pieces of if the ANC performs better than expected in this election, these will be some of the reasons. And I think Thabo Mbeki endorsing the party publicly so close to the election will be one of the pieces that I think brings them back up. Terence, what do you make of this this story?
Well, the Thabo Mbeki era is a time people look back on fondly. You know, so I remember there was a lot of optimism in the country at that point. Well, I lived in Taiwan for a good chunk of it. I remember coming back to South Africa, and, you know, Joburg, you know, every year it looked a bit shinier. And, I remember Cresta in particular, lots of specialty shops. It was nice. Now, I think, though, that there's some mistakes being made. I think that... In the analysis, I think Thabo Mbeki was a far more capable man than either Jacob Zuma or Cyril Ramaphosa. But I think, you know, we did have global markets in our favor. You know, the commodities boom. Although even at that point, it was becoming apparent that, you know, there were things that were breaking down. South Africa increased its commodity receipts, but not so much its output. I remember hearing South Africa's coal output had increased by 3% over that period. Australia's by something like 60%. You know, that sort of thing was clear. Mbeki drove a sort of ruthless campaign of racial transformation, and it took some time for that to for the impact of that to feed through. There was also a very lackadaisical approach to corruption. Remember Jackie Celebi, whom he refused, you know, I remember him telling church leaders, just trust me on this, a famous last words. And then, of course, remember his AIDS policies. You know, I think, if, you know, when they stand before the great public protector in the sky, that's something that Zuma can say. Well, I gave, you know, I reversed AIDS policy and, like, life expectancy shot up by 10 years or whatever it was overnight. But yeah, you know, I think it's sort of clasping for whatever resources are available. And, you know, I think that what you are hearing from those people is very much a part of our political culture, not unique to South Africa. That political allegiance can be very bound up with people's identity. Helen Zille used to say this, that you know, she would try and, you know, persuade women in Khayelitsha whom she had helped, and they would say, Helen, you know, no one else does anything for us, and you've done this, and you've done that, but we are ANC. And she, I remember her emphasizing that phrase, we are ANC, not we support the ANC. It's almost, you know, it's like kind of family relationship that, you know, your dad might be a drunk, but he is your dad.
Right.
You know, I remember also, you know, I think this, it was kind of explained to me in these terms that people are hutful with the ANC, they're all crooks, all corrupt, whatever. The election comes closer, people get excited, the ANC starts to campaign, there's lots of nostalgia. There are these street parties that the ANC throws money at. Those who are considering voting elsewhere don't want to be excluded. And, you know, you sort of join the parade. So, yes, I think that the predictions of the catastrophic decline might be overstated, but I do think they're more trouble than they've ever been before.
No, I think that's broadly correct. There's something kind of that makes one sort of despair, as you say, the sort of family analogy, in that middle quote from that guy, I think his name is Polania Motumi, who I was quoted, who said, "What can we do? It's our party." And he also says in that same little quote to the media there that we have been there for it. We have been there for the ANC. And you kind of get this, it's this sort of, you can almost see like someone going to pick up their troubled son from the rehab clinic in that sentence. There's a kind of strange emotional attachment that's really not being reciprocated and that people recognize. And as you say, I think, you know, the inertia of the ANC being this huge organization that has had such an impact on the country does give it a lot of benefit in political sphere. Anlu, what do you make of this? I mean, do you think Thabo Mbeki is going to be able to turn around some of the ANC's fortunes by campaigning heavily for them? Do you think they're going to do better than some of the polling has predicted?
Nicholas, I don't think I'm in a position to say whether they'll do better, but what I can say is I don't think they'll do as bad as predicted. And I do think, however, that the fact that they're pulling out their seniors is really, it does point to the fact that they are desperate a little bit. It might also just be because it's coming to an end and they are, as you said, pulling everything or throwing the whole kitchen sink. I'm not sure what that metaphor is, but they're throwing everything they have at it. But something that I noticed here is, again, it comes up with the grants. And I think that's it plays a big role in the whole campaigning. And although you've heard many of the other parties also bringing it up and at least mentioning that they're not planning on taking it away, I think here it is really clear that the people, at least that the one person who was interviewed said that it's the 350 makes a difference. And what I'd like to point out, with the hope that it's not repetitive or too repetitive at least, is the fact that the 350 wouldn't have been necessary if it wasn't for them. It's not the solution. It does make it better, but it would have been much better if you actually had a job that gave you, for example, 3,500 rand or 350,000 a year. So it instead of seeing the 350 there as contributing to their campaign, I think it should really be seen as a burden rather. But I don't think that's the sentiment on the ground.
Yeah, I think that is actually a very good point about how South Africans seem to have this quite, unfortunately, you know, many South Africans have a very low kind of bar of where they think things should be. And I think this has been actually a success of the ANC in a sense, is that they have managed to convince the population that this is probably about as good as it's going to get. And so people will say, hey, well, they gave us 350 rand grant, you know, that's something we didn't used to have that before. And that's true, and that has, you know, helped people to buy food and essentials and just to make ends meet, particularly when the economy is in a rough state. But it's because I think so many people have just given up hope that they will ever be in a place where they will have a job, they will be free from crime, they will be able to look forward to a future for their kids that is significantly different from the lives they live. We're kind of in this sort of zombie sleepwalk mode in so many ways as a country, I fear. And people just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's how it is. And that, I think, is exactly the thing that benefits the status quo and the way things are currently going. Terence, any final thoughts before we close up?
If I may, I see one of our viewers has asked how the ANC is different from political cult. I do think it's worth pointing out that this is not a uniquely South African phenomenon. You know, I've encountered people, you know, who vote Labour in Britain because my dad voted Labour and my grandpa voted Labour. You know, Tories who, you know, listen to the guy and he actually sounds quite of the left, but you know, this is what my family's always been. So this is not unique. But I do think that sort of call it a almost generational vote or a tribal vote or whatever, where it's bound up with who you feel you are. It comes with costs, ultimately, this is a weapon that South Africa's people have willfully squander if they're not willing to use it as a tool for accountability. To say in the same breath, well, you know, it's our party, but there's all these rogues in it. Well, then don't vote the rogues in it, because that is how your party will remain. In fact, I did actually speak to a long-time ANC supporter, a guy who's been sort of involved on and off for like 30 years, and he said, I can't vote for the ANC because it has to lose power, and I'm doing this because I love it so much. Which I think there's a funny logic there, but
I think that's a much healthier approach than the what can we do that one guy interviewed here suggests. Anyway, we are a bit over time, so thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back on Monday with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.